You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host, Bill Humphrey.
491.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware. I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. I'm coming to you on December 16th, 2013, from my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. Ahead this hour, Greg joins me to talk about Wall Street's big plans for renters, a ruling on the NSA, and a U.S. drone strike in Yemen. Arsenal for Democracy is usually recorded in studio every Monday and is available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes and other locations. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Email us at afdradio@gmail.com or call and leave a message with your views and questions at 347-688-6676. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me again this week from Maryland is my guest co-host, Greg. Greg, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me again.
Let's jump right into this. The first story that I wanted to tackle was about the emerging Blackstone global slumlord empire. Blackstone is a private equity firm that is, you know, partly owned by most of the major banks that operate on Wall Street, including some of the European banks. And these are some of the same banks that were involved in the shenanigans of the securitized mortgages, the collateralized debt obligations, and other financial instruments that I've been blasting on the show for quite some time now.
And if you liked those, you're going to love this.
Right. Yeah. If you were a huge fan of investment bank induced market meltdowns from speculative financial instruments and fictional investment products, this one's going to be a great one. This was a story that was really hacked into by Mother Jones, kind of did a lot of the legwork on figuring out what was going on. Particularly, this was published November 29th, but this was prompted by a Wall Street Journal article at the end of October. The initial notice by the that was kind of being discussed by the Wall Street Journal was the first offering of a package of 479 million new securities by Blackstone. And that's, again, almost half a billion dollars, right? And you're wondering, okay, what exciting product have they turned into securities here? And this is where it gets real interesting. That half billion initial offering there on those was for 3,207 single-family rental homes offered by, owned by Blackstone and their various subsidiaries. In particular, they have this one company called Invitation Homes. According to the Wall Street Journal, Invitation Homes has bought $7 billion worth of houses this year alone, and by the end of October was spending at a rate of $100 million a week. So they were buying up foreclosed homes, and then they were turning them into rental properties, single-family rental properties. And a lot of people have been moving back into the rental market because of the problems with the housing sector after the bubble burst in 2007. And they are doing the exact same thing that they did with the mortgages, the mortgage payments, and bundling up instead rental payments. So the way it used to be was that you had the mortgage-backed packages where you would say, okay, we know that out of these, you know, 500 homes or something, there's going to be this number of mortgage payments coming, you know, 500 payments coming every month for a certain amount of money. We know what the amount of money is going to be. We have a good estimate, right? We sell these instruments, these financial investment products off to other companies. And that means that you get a share or most of the profits on these homes that have been sold by the local bank back home, not local like, you know, locally owned, but local like, you know, that you can access locally as opposed to being on Wall Street. these the profits end up being, you know, in the form of the mortgage payments end up being divided out to the various companies that buy up these shares. And this time, not mortgages, but rental payments. And so, you know, as long as it's going to hum along great, as long as everyone makes their payments on time, we know that renters are notoriously great about paying all of their rental payments on time because it's just the easiest thing in the world to do. And nobody ever has a problem with that. Of course, that being the opposite of the case, but, essentially they're saying, okay, we expect 95% of our units to be occupied at any one time. And that is deemed to be pretty insane by people who actually work full-time in the rental properties management industry as opposed to just doing this as a financial scheme on Wall Street, right? And this Blackstone by itself owns 200,000 mostly foreclosed homes now. They have bought these up, turned them into these rental properties through groups like that Invitation Homes, right? And because they have turned them into securitized packages, these are no longer a way for people to get homes. These are money-making machines. So they're saying, here are the securities. We expect a certain amount of money every month. Therefore, you have to pay exactly the full amount on time, no exceptions. And the result is that in Charlotte, North Carolina, according to Mother Jones, they've already had to start evicting 10% of their occupants, which is going to put them well below their 95% occupancy rate that they're going for. And the reason that I said at the top of the segment that this is a global operation is that in addition to the 200,000 homes in the United States, Blackstone, one of the world's larger companies, is trying to do the same in Spain. For those who haven't been following the intricacies of European economies for the past few years, Spain is the other big country in the advanced world that had a major housing bubble burst at the exact same time. They had a huge mortgage explosion there as well. And so they've got a lot of foreclosed homes too. So Blackstone's going to try to buy up those so that they can have this this rental homes empire across the U.S. Sun Belt and then also in Spain. Now, I also said at the beginning of the segment, I referred to it as a slumlord empire. And the reason I say that is because the reports are that this Invitation Homes, it's not like they bought up an existing rental property management firm. They created their own from scratch and they haven't actually been doing a whole lot of rental property managing because this isn't their specialty. And there have been lots of reports from the renters about various problems like cockroaches and water bugs and things like that. This is cited in the article, various other problems that are typical of rental units, right? But they're not being addressed in any way. So that's where we stand on this story. I would encourage people to look into that Mother Jones article for more information. You know, and I also did go look at this, you know, Wall Street Journal article in detail. Now, the Wall Street Journal side, much more favorable toward this. The argument in favor of this is that buying up all these properties in huge numbers and well above the asking prices, because that's how they outbid people with regular little people mortgage financing and stuff like that. They're outbidding for these rental properties, and this is therefore boosting the rest of the housing market, and that's going to help everyone. That's their argument anyway. But I'm a little bit skeptical of that argument. Greg, let's get you in here after this lengthy summary of the situation. What are your thoughts initially on this situation?
Well, I understand the reason why it's advantageous for them to do something like this, basically packaging up all of this rental risk and selling it to somebody else and then getting money up front so that they can go out and buy even more houses and do the same thing over and over and over again. And you'll, as you pointed out, I mean, even though this is almost $500 million with their initial offering, that's only, you know, a couple thousand houses. And as you said before, they have over 200,000 houses that they've already bought up in the United States alone. So I think that the contention that the Wall Street Journal was making, that this is going to boost the housing market, it's problematic in that it's going to boost the housing market at the expense of people that actually need the houses, because no longer are people like you and I able to buy up these foreclosed homes, as you were saying. They're getting outbid by Blackstone, who is paying well above market value for the foreclosed homes because they can afford to do so, because they're going to bundle up the rental, the rent payments, and then sell it and then do the same thing over and over again. So I definitely think that this is not something that I was aware of until you pointed it out to me. I'm not in the housing market right now, being that I'm still renting. But this is definitely something that I find concerning, especially as someone that wants to eventually own a home. Now it looks as if people or organizations like Blackstone are going to be buying homes that otherwise would go to people like me.
Yeah, and as you say, from Wall Street's perspective, this makes sense, at least on paper, right? They're making the rising tides lift all boats argument that these properties would be going unsold for extended periods of time. Who knows if that's true? Probably not as much as they're going to claim, right? And that these were owned by banks, and the banks are the owners of Blackstone. So kind of a circular loop there that they're going to hopefully make back some of the money that they lost when these properties went bust before. And then they're going to have these additional cash flows from these securitized rental payments, these bundled rental payments. And then they're also going to say that everyone stands to benefit because it's going to restore the other foreclosed home values and the other underwater values. And then everyone's going to be able to, other people will be able to buy homes, and there will be more, mortgages will be recovered. People won't be walking away because they won't be underwater on their mortgages, and so on and so forth. It's very pie in the sky view that this is going to help everyone. I really don't think that it is. I think we're setting up another really bad bubble situation here. And the fact that they, rental property management is not a game. It's a very difficult thing. I think my grandfather, who used to rent out to people, was always claiming that he was going to write a book called 30 Days Notice about all the trials and tribulations of being a property management person, or informally or formally. I think it was kind of his side operation. But, it's something that requires a lot of attention, a lot of energy, a lot of time, and a lot of money. And that's definitely not going to be handled by the men in suits who come down from Wall Street briefly to pay cash up front for buying out these properties. And we've already started to see that they haven't been doing a very good job. And this isn't just bad for the renters, it's bad for themselves as an operation too, because as the articles have pointed out, it's not going to work unless they can actually get people to stay in these apartments, right? And that's not great. There was an interesting observation at the very end of the Wall Street Journal article from October. It said, Fitch Ratings said that it wouldn't rate deals like this one above single A because transactions are new and are highly vulnerable to costs such as repairs, capital, and property taxes. And unlike the mortgage payments where they're literally just getting a payment every month, and then if the payments stop, you kick the person out, they've got to be making expenditures too. They're treating this as the same type of cash flow, but it's not like that. You've got to continue to make the payments and make the upkeep and maintenance on these and pay all these other things. Like property taxes is not something that you had to pay when you were the mortgage holder, right? But now that you're the actual property owner, you do have to pay for that. So they clearly think that they've thought it out, but I would question whether or not they've thought it through. And to circle back, you were kind of touching on this, the way that the bundling was working. They get their money back right away while not having to actually do any property maintenance, apparently, in their minds on these properties. And then they can go buy, 100,000 more houses or something like that. So that's why they've started doing the offerings here. And, but again, there's half a billion in securities, almost half a billion, right? And they're only 3,200 houses or something out of the 200,000 that they've got. But they're just, going to try to keep shoveling, they're bringing it in the front door while shoveling it out the back door. And that only works to a certain point. And that's where you got into the situation with the mortgages problem in the housing market. There was that you had to get the reason that the subprime part of that bubble happened was that you had to keep on getting more stuff in the front to be able to get the other stuff out the back and vice versa. You had to come up with more packages and more instruments to sell. You had to have more mortgages to bundle. Therefore, you had to, start offering people who shouldn't have been buying homes these credit opportunities. Now, of course, I think it's worth noting here that the very people that have, conservatives were saying, oh, these people shouldn't have been owning homes. They weren't saying that under George W. Bush, who was trying to get everyone into homes anyway. But, after that, they're saying, oh, this was irresponsible. These people shouldn't have been homeowners. It was their fault, not the company's fault. You know, even though this was being pushed very aggressively on them, these people have now bounced back into that rental tier, right? And they're, you know, now we're going to be potentially screwing them over on the rental side as well. So where do you drive the people out to after their rental options go away because they've been kicked out? And there was an example in the Mother Jones thing, not just people who, you know, didn't make the payment on time or whatever, but also people who did make the payment on time and the company didn't process it right. So just like Bank of America preemptively foreclosing on homes of people who had actually paid, we're going to see people getting evicted by Blackstone subsidiaries for mistakes in paperwork or whatever, and they'll do it immediately because they want to keep getting these monthly cash flows happening back to their investors on a regular basis. So, you know, we've pushed the people out that you said weren't supposed to be in the housing market. Now you're going to take them, you know, out in the next market down. Greg, you were mentioning before the show about kind of the realization about who exactly was affected the most by the recession is these populations that were particularly, you know, had worked really hard to get where they were. And then, you know, now they're even more vulnerable than ever.
That's right. In the Mother Jones article, I believe it said something like during the financial crisis that 53% of African-American wealth and 66% of Hispanic wealth was destroyed between 2005 and 2009 with the mortgage crisis, with racially discriminatory lending practices. And that number, when you think about it, is staggering. 53% of African-American wealth, 66% of Hispanic wealth. And so you're talking about these people that they can't own homes anymore because Blackstone is buying them up. They might not be able to rent homes anymore because Blackstone kicks them out, or whoever Blackstone hires to run their rental properties kicks them out on the day after they miss a payment, or if they don't even miss a payment, like you mentioned. And this is very problematic when you talk about these communities, the African American community, the Hispanic community, that have been so disserviced by what's happened in the past maybe 8 years. This is just another blow for them. This is just another blow. They've been taken down peg after peg after peg, and now that companies like Blackstone are getting into the rental market and bundling rentals and making securities with this type of stuff. Where do we go from here? Where do the people that can't buy homes, that can't rent homes, where do they go?
And I have a feeling that there's going to be a strong pressure to jack up the rents too, pretty frequently, and probably more frequently than would normally be happening, because, you know, much like the adjustable rate mortgage operations, which were sort of scammy, you know, the idea of let's give them a low ball at the beginning and then it goes up very quickly, and as long as your home value continues to go up quickly, then it's fine. But of course it didn't. You know, that was a way of extracting more money per mortgage. This way they're going to start having a pressure to extract more cash per unit, especially as those other costs add up, you know, or people start leaving unexpectedly or having to evict at a higher rate, things like that. That's going to be a tremendous pressure. So you may even be getting people out of the rental market, you know, pricing them out of the rental market in these areas. And these are a lot of, you know, sort of low to mid-income areas as well. These are Sunbelt places that are typically lower cost of living than, say, the Northeast. So now you're taking people who were maybe reasonably solidly lower middle class. They weren't, you know, the middle tier. They certainly weren't upper middle class, but they were above working poor. Now you're really going to be putting a tremendous financial pressure on those people.
Yep.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy from WVUD and arsenalfordemocracy.com. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I am Bill. My co-host Greg is still on the line. We're going to turn now to the story out of Washington today, the federal district court ruling on the NSA. I want to get this up front and out of the way first, a George W. Bush appointed member of the federal judiciary making this ruling. I think that's of some significance. And he ruled that this was a fairly narrow ruling that will, you know, did not go into effect immediately and will probably be struck down by higher court levels. I think Greg and I are both in agreement on that point.
Yes.
But Richard Leon, U.S. District Court judge, was ruling on two particular cases. Two people wanted their information removed from the database, not because they had done anything wrong or whatever, but they assumed that their data had been collected, given the vacuuming that's been going on, as we found out from the Snowden docs. And they said that this was, you know, an unconstitutional violation of their protections against unreasonable searches. And he said that the NSA's, quote, almost Orwellian technology was not something that would have been conceived of the, you know, the last time there was a major privacy ruling like this about surveillance technology. For those who aren't in the loop, this refers back to a 1970s ruling, actually. So quite a while at this point now, which was... had nothing to do with the NSA, actually. It had to do with a more standard law enforcement thing. It was a situation. There's a whole, I think it was a Wired.com article explaining it. But basically, this guy had stolen someone's purse and then started stalking her based on the information. And she was trying to get like a restraining order against him and try to get him arrested for harassment and such. And the police, they decided rather than like wiretapping his phone, they just built a case by getting the metadata, which was asking the phone company to physically produce a record of how many calls he had made to bother her and, you know, anybody else that he might be bothering. And his, you know, his lawyers argued that this was an invasive, unreasonable search, right? That they didn't, you know, they may have had a warrant or whatever, but he didn't necessarily know that he was going to be monitored. And at the time, the Supreme Court said, well, look, everyone gets a monthly bill from their long distance company saying how many calls they had made. So they know that the company is monitoring it. So therefore, they should be aware that that's a possibility. Now, the dissenting dissenting opinion by, I believe it was Justice Blackmun, said that he thought metadata was actually fairly invasive in and of itself, because unlike with the contents of a conversation where you can self-censor, it's harder to self-censor the like who, why, and where, and when type of, you know, stuff, which is what metadata essentially is. And so Richard Leon in today's decision basically kind of pointing back to that decision and saying, look, like maybe that was a reasonable expectation at the time, but it doesn't seem reasonable now. And at the very least, we've got to get some sort of updated ruling. Plus, the NSA never really got, you know, a open ruling by the Supreme Court on their activities on this particular point. There was a different decision, right? But that decision wasn't even about them, and they said this is the legal basis for their entire operation. Temporarily, this isn't in effect, but the judge also said, quote, the relationship between the police and the phone company is nothing compared to the relationship that has apparently evolved over the last 7 years between the government and telecom companies. It's one thing to say that people expect phone companies to occasionally provide information to law enforcement. It's quite another to suggest that our citizens expect all phone companies to operate what is effectively a joint intelligence gathering operation within the government. And then, Greg, you wanted to comment in particular on the sort of efficacy angle of his decision about whether or not this is even a useful program.
That's right. So Judge Leon not only said that this was of questionable constitutionality under the Fourth Amendment, but that he also said that I don't know if this really serves the purpose that the NSA says that it's serving. The quote in particular that I thought was very telling was Judge Leon said, I'm not convinced at this point in the litigation that the NSA's database has ever truly served the purpose of rapidly identifying terrorists in time-sensitive investigations, and I am certainly, and that's his emphasis, not mine, not convinced that the removal of two individuals, hearkening back to what this original case was about, which was two people decided that they were going to sue the federal government because they didn't want their data on the NSA list. So certainly not convinced that the removal of two individuals from the database will, quote, degrade the program in any meaningful sense. And I think that that is a response to the government's contention that there's been a lot of talk of connecting the data points where they're combing all of this data. They're casting a very, very wide net to people that they don't necessarily believe are involved with anything, but that they're trying to amass an enormous amount of data points so that they can, quote, connect the dots and potentially pinpoint some sorts of threats to national security. And Judge Leon contends that removing two people from the NSA database will not, as the government contends, degrade the program in any meaningful sense.
Right. And there's sort of two counter arguments to this data flood argument that the NSA has been favoring this whole time. One of them is just the argument that the FBI and the folks who actually follow up on these leads are completely overwhelmed by the number of leads they're being given. The other argument, and this is a more qualitative one that I think is fairly compelling as well, Amy Zalman from the National War College had written an op-ed in when the NSA revelations this summer started coming out. She wrote a piece in The Globalist about how the needle in the haystack approach, which the NSA frequently uses that phrase, the needle in the haystack approach doesn't make sense because we're not supposed to be building haystacks to look for needles. We're supposed to be thinking logically about a, you know, narrative or storyline that leads from point A to point B to someone planning a terrorist attack that we can intercept using the relevant communication tools, right? You know, we have to know that they're communicating by a means that the NSA is looking at, as opposed to, I don't know what, going super low tech and communicating in Inca knots or whatever that can't be intercepted by signals intelligence. But, you know, we have to know that they're communicating that way. We have to understand what the various so-called chatter that we're picking up actually means. Is it of any significance? We have to know, like, you know, where to be looking in the world for these potential things. We have to kind of have a framework already built that within which an attack will occur. We can't just go out, you know, into the wild digital jungle, you know, with a machete looking around for anything that jumps out at us, right? Like, this is not the approach to counterterrorism that we need. And the FBI has been handling counterterrorism stuff fine on its own well before the NSA. There were far more terrorist attacks before the NSA turned from Cold War focus to counterterrorism age of internet focus in the 90s and 2000s, right? There were more attacks happening in the 70s and 80s that the FBI had to deal with. But the NSA making the argument that, you know, well, now that we've got access to all this stuff and that some of the communication has moved online, a lot of it, of course, you know, that this is the way to go. But maybe that's not the way to go. Maybe we need to not be vacuuming up huge amounts of data, you know, by the yottabyte to put into data centers in Utah. Maybe we need to be not just looking for patterns generically, but kind of hunting down likely patterns that will lead to something. Because it's nonsensical that we're collecting the contents of 70 to 80 million phone calls in a 30-day period in France and that's somehow going to keep us safer, right? I mean, that's just truly absurd. And that's kind of the argument I think that Judge Leon was making there as well.
Right. How could it possibly lead to a time-sensitive tip on a terroristic threat if you have that much data? How is that possible?
Right. And just to get that sheer amount of data necessarily means that you have over-collected a massive quantity of information and contents from people who have nothing to do with anything. And they have those absurd friend of a terrorist rule that they've been following, right? It's not even someone who knows a terrorist personally. It's someone who accidentally accepted a Facebook friend request from someone who had accepted a Facebook friend request from someone who knows a terrorist or whatever. Like, I'm sure that I'm probably 2 or 3 degrees away from some terrorist in Pakistan or whatever, just because I know people that, you know, probably are cousins with somebody's cousin who is a terrorist in the Northwest frontier region in Pakistan, right? And they may not, the person that I ultimately know may have nothing to do with terrorism and may not support it, right? But they're 2 or 3 degrees away from someone who does. And there, it's so irrelevant as to make it unwieldy and useless for counterterrorism purposes, and ultimately is unconstitutional as well. The other thing, though, that we wanted to talk about briefly is kind of why this isn't going to get struck down. I had some thoughts, but Greg, why don't you go ahead and say why you think the program's not going to get struck down at higher levels?
I'm not particularly confident that in the Supreme Court, which ultimately I think what this is going to go to, are going to stand up to the government. I think the government can talk a lot about this is necessary for national security and we've prevented X number of terrorist attacks and the like. And there's nothing that any civilian can do to refute any of that because we're dependent on
the information we're given.
Exactly. We're dependent on the, I mean, I can't with certainty say that the number that they say, if it's, you know, one terrorist attack or it's 1,000 terrorist attacks that have been prevented through this massive data mining operation that the NSA has started, I can't refute any of that because I have no idea, because obviously the terrorist attack didn't happen. So it's, I think, very difficult to make an argument about the efficacy, and I applaud Richard Leon for attempting to do that. I just don't think that it's going to be an argument that is a winning one. It's possible that they might try to do something, obviously, more along the lines of the Fourth Amendment, a reasonable search and seizure. But I think that it's also not unreasonable to think that the government could argue successfully that given the highly connected age in which we live, where, you know, Google is collecting all information all of the time, that Facebook is collecting all of our information all of the time, that our telephone providers are collecting all of our information all the time, that we have any reasonable expectation of privacy, and so that it's not a reasonable search and seizure. And now, granted, this is not what I'm saying, because obviously I don't believe that, but I think that this is something that the government will be able to argue successfully if and when it ever gets up to the Supreme Court. And I'd also like to point out that the courts, especially the FISA court, has tried to stand up to the NSA before behind closed doors, as it's later come out, and not been very successful.
Right.
So I don't think that anything with the public scrutiny, I don't think that the public scrutiny that the Supreme Court can and will undergo for this case, if it's seen before it, I don't think that they're going to have any more luck going up against what the government purports it's doing in pursuance of national security than the FISA court did.
Right. I think there's a whole bunch of pressures that are going to act against the Supreme Court, you know, changing its mind on this. You bring up the FISA court. As Greg was alluding to there was, I think it was in September or so, the chief of the FISA court, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, wrote a letter to the Washington Post saying email to the Washington Post saying essentially that they have no oversight because the NSA tells them what the NSA wants to tell them. They are supposed to have oversight over the NSA, but they are dependent on the information the NSA provides, and they have no way of checking into it independently on their own, and they have no way of enforcing their decisions. So when they have ruled against the NSA, they're fairly confident at this point that the NSA has not been following a lot of their directives, and they have no way to check it or enforce it. And because all of this is secret and highly classified, they can't exactly complain publicly about this or bring this to anyone's attention, because, you know, that subverts the purpose of the security and the classification and national security, blah, 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 blah. Effectively, the oversight mechanism is powerless to act here. Now let's think about, where does this court mechanism come from? Well, it does come in part from Congress, which has traditionally given more and more powers to the NSA, but it also is appointed personally by the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, John Roberts, and he's going to look like he has a lot of egg on his face if he rules that the NSA has been operating completely unconstitutionally and totally out of bounds this entire time, and has been ignoring the, you know, court, or he could rule that the court messed up in some ruling, right? That's going to look like he messed up because these people that he personally appointed didn't do what they were supposed to do, even if they, you know, it wasn't their fault, as they are arguing. And then beyond that, this is the same court, you know, the liberal side's changed, but the conservative majority is still intact. The same court that ruled not exactly in favor, but also not really against the telecoms surveillance stuff and activities of they weren't really collecting so much of the metadata, but I guess it was some of the call records, so I guess that was some metadata. But this was back with the warrantless domestic program that the New York Times discovered in 2004 and then didn't report for a year. But in 2006, I think it was, there was a ruling by the Supreme Court that said, yes, this is unconstitutional, but only because Congress hasn't authorized it. So then, you know, in 2008, Congress authorized it. Right. So like that was a nominal ruling that a program is unconstitutional, but not really unconstitutional, just more illegal. I mean, I think it's unconstitutional, but that's not what the court said. But I agree with Greg in some that this is not going to really progress to anything. But I do also applaud Judge Leon for trying to put this into public record about why this doesn't make any sense what we're doing. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy from WVUD and arsenalfordemocracy.com. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I am Bill Humphrey. My co-host is Greg. We're going to actually turn now to talk about some of the things that we've been seeing overseas that are of interest. The one I wanted to get us started off on is the drone strike that happened in Yemen, U.S. drone strike that killed a lot of members of a wedding party. Greg, why don't you introduce the basics of this story and get us started on that discussion?
Well, I believe it was CNN reported that last week, government sources in Yemen indicated that there was a drone strike that attacked a party that was attending a wedding. 14 people were killed. 22 others were injured. 9 of them are in critical condition. The party was traveling, again, to a wedding. It subsequently came out, I think, in maybe a type of revisionist quick history that a number of these individuals that were in the wedding party were associated with Al-Qaeda. I'm not sure the veracity of that. Again, as we were saying before, you need to take American intelligence at its word. However, it's obviously very problematic that this would happen at all, and especially on a day where the White House, in the very same day, was commenting on the execution of the North Korean leader's uncle and was saying that it's obvious that North Korea has no respect for human rights or human life. And then the very same day would have to contend with the news that there was a drone strike on a wedding party that killed 14 people and stands to probably kill more given that 7 are in critical condition.
Right. And there was, even higher tolls reported by some other publications. But again, yeah, as you said, you know, they immediately said, oh, well, 5 of the people were suspected of involvement with Al-Qaeda. This is part of a report here from Connor Friedersdorf on the Atlantic website. He raised a lot of great points. He argued, for example, about, you know, the outrage that would have followed if there had been a drone attack on a U.S. wedding, whether by accident by the U.S. or by, you know, anyone else. Hey, think about it. Could be the U.S. if you decided to have a destination wedding in the mountains between Afghanistan and Pakistan. I don't know how many people do, but it's possible. And he was saying, you know, this is just such an outrage. And it was bringing to my mind, too, that I believe it was in 2006 or maybe 2004. There was a wedding that was bombed by terrorists in Amman, Jordan. A lot of people died at that one. And I just remembered this now, so I may be a little hazy on the details. But I seem to remember, like, the immediate reaction to this was not a U.S. bombing. This was a terrorist bombing. The immediate reaction was, like, everyone was overwhelmingly, you know, against the terrorists, you know, very upset about this, understandably, and joining together to say this was unacceptable. And that was, you know, again, that was one attack on one wedding. And think about, this is not even the first wedding, I believe, if I remember correctly, that the U.S. has in either Pakistan or Yemen accidentally bombed. People
are literally not getting together in large groups out there anymore. So if they have a funeral that they need to attend, they don't go to it. If they have a wedding that they need to attend, they don't go to it. Now, obviously, these people weren't so lucky because they decided that, you know, we're not going to be intimidated by, you know, these drone strikes. We're going to get together. We're going to have this wonderful celebration. And then 14 of them end up dead.
Right. You know, the United States has backwards defined, according to a number of sources over the past few years, defined basically anyone over the age of like 14, particularly if they own a firearm, you know, in these other countries as terrorists. Now, where are all the, you know, U.S. gun advocates explaining how this is tyranny that anyone with a gun over the age of 14 is classified as a terrorist in other countries from the perspective of the CIA or the U.S. Air Force or whoever's operating these armed military drones on behalf of the United States? You know, where's the outrage there? And in Pakistan, that's a very heavily armed country. A lot of people fit that bill, even if they're not engaged in terrorist activities. They may just have it for defensive purposes, which is pretty understandable when you're living in the middle of total chaos. And yet, Yemen, I believe, has the highest gun ownership rate in the world. I think it's something like multiple firearms per, you know, person, and about like 90 some odd percent of the population. I think it's close to 97 or something like that. Percent of the population owns a gun. You know, this is per capita, they have the highest gun ownership rate in the world. So it's not surprising that you could theoretically link anyone to terrorism or suspected terrorism in any of these countries, whether or not they were involved in that. Plus, worth remembering that there's a lot of internal conflicts in Yemen. There have been for many, many decades. And people have armed themselves for that because they've had a fairly significant civil war there. So, of course, they're going to be armed and, you know, participating in various actions. They may never go to the United States or attack any American interest. They may solely be involved in activities against other, you know, family groups, you know, as part of blood feuds or whatever. But, it, you know, notably, we're not going around drone bombing every, you know, ethnic Serb or Bosnian or Croatian who, you know, picks up a gun to go after somebody in a blood feud there. And, you know, maybe we would have, I don't know, back in the day. But this is certainly a problematic approach that's not winning any friends. And, you know, people will say, oh, well, that argument's really exaggerated that everyone's going to just go become a terrorist out of anger because of this, whatever. But the government of Yemen got brought down in the Arab Spring because of its support for the United States drone campaigns. This is why the Yemeni government is not so on board with this anymore, is because the new government that replaced them, basically still essentially the same people with a different person in charge, but their like big policy thing is, we do not support the drone strikes. Now, of course, they probably have an unofficial bilateral agreement with the United States, just like their predecessors did, just like it's come out from these various other leaks that Pakistan did, right? And that makes a lot of Pakistanis angry that their government has been saying that they're opposed to this violation of sovereignty the whole time, but then is actually backing it in exchange for money. I'm sure there's a similar agreement in place in Yemen, but, you know, it's not great. And it does undermine the legitimacy of the central government. That sovereignty argument seems kind of abstract and it is a little bit hard to parse. But the basic premise is that if another country can at any given point in time blow a group of people at, you know, into smithereens with no repercussions or any response from their own government, then that government does not have what's known as a monopoly on violence. I mean, that's kind of goes back to central social compact agreements that we talked about, like when Persephone was on the show and we were discussing the Egyptian situation and kind of the social contract between the people and the government, why they form a government. The idea, at least if you buy into the Hobbesian theories and so on and so forth, is that you want to have the government be the only party that's allowed to enact violence. Now, obviously, that's not really realistic in Pakistan or parts of Pakistan or most of Yemen. But it definitely undermines the legitimacy of the central government when there's no response at all that they can possibly make against the United States just coming in, flying in arbitrarily and launching hellfire missiles at people who haven't even arguably done anything. You know, and so that is not great for regional stability either, in addition to fostering all this kind of general chaos and anti-Americanism that's ultimately going to come back and bite us. And the question is, why are we persisting in doing these strikes? I mean, that's the argument that Friedersdorf was making in The Atlantic, is like, why are we still doing this after all this time with so many strikes that have killed all these people who aren't militants, all these innocent civilians? It's causing all these problems. Why are we not getting better at it or stopping it?
And I think the government would argue that, in fact, we would see a lot more civilian casualties if we went in there with boots on the ground, or if we went in there with traditional Air Force strikes, and that drones can be surgically targeted to take out specific individuals. But as we've seen time and time again, it doesn't seem very surgical to kill 14 people in a wedding party. I mean, if you were having a surgery that you need to get your gallbladder removed and they took off both your legs, that's kind of the analogy that I would use here.
It's not doing the job that it's supposed to do. Much like the you know, the arguments against the NSA data mining there, right? It's not accomplishing the basic function that it's supposed to be achieving. Thank you so much again for coming back on this week on Arsenal for Democracy. It is great to have you on, and we should have you on again quite soon, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now it's time for my 60-second spot. There's an awful lot of chatter these days from nutters about the need for arming oneself against tyranny, with dark references to the early days of the American Revolution. The implication is usually that some people in this country must have forgotten how we started. It's probably worth noting that the instigating incidents of the battles of Lexington and Concord happened in Massachusetts, when the British went to try and seize a colonial militia armory preemptively. As a native, I can assure the rest of the country that we definitely haven't forgotten about any of the early events leading to the Revolution. Massachusetts took a lot of the brunt of the British response before and during the American Revolution. It remains a big part of Massachusetts history classes from grade school through high school, and the historical sites are literally all around us. I think Bay Staters, liberal though we are, have a solid handle on how the American Revolution began and what unreasonable government oppression looks like. If the country truly were experiencing tyranny, Massachusetts would have pointed it out by now. That's my time. And indeed, that's all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening to Arsenal for Democracy for December 16th, 2013. Next week, an online-only half episode will be available at our new website, arsenalfordemocracy.com, by Monday evening. The show is recorded at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts weekly and is available for download from arsenalfordemocracy.com on Tuesdays. You can also hear a repeat of it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark, and you can stream it at WVUD.org every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Special thanks to my voiceover man, Justin. You can follow his work at the Digitized Ramblings of an 8-Bit Animal from 8BitAnimal.com. And thanks to my guest co-host, Greg. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.